now it gives me a great pleasure to introduce our speaker for the evening. Let's welcome Johnny from San Jose.
Yay!
Hi, I'm Johnny. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Johnny.
And by the grace of God, the 12 steps, 12 traditions, good sponsorship, these rooms. I am sober and grateful for that. I remember my first 90 days of sobriety, hearing people say that they're grateful alcoholics, and I'm like, you guys are crazy. Like, what are you talking about? Grateful? My life is a mess right now. Like, everything sucks. What are you talking about? How can you be grateful? I mean, I'd be grateful for some alcohol right now. What's your problem? But as I worked the process and worked the steps with the sponsor, I realized that I was always wanting more. I was always wanting what I didn't have, and nothing was ever good enough. And I always felt uncomfortable, and I always felt less than, and I never felt part of. And what this fellowship and a power greater than myself has given me was exactly that. And so I'm grateful that I went through the trials and tribulations of an alcoholic to find this light at the end of the tunnel, and thank God it wasn't a train, you know? Because it was looking like a train. It was definitely, you know, there was a train wreck, and that was me. I'm sure a lot of you guys have similar experiences, and I'm the type of alcoholic that had to wreck to surrender. And another thing that I hated that word surrender as a in my first 90 days, because I grew up in a military family, and surrendering was not an option. You fight in a different direction. And my sponsor is in the military, and he's like, you just fight a different direction. I'm all right, I can surrender that way. And he's like, and if you think about it, what are you doing when you're surrendering? And I'm like, well, you're giving up. And he's all right, that's one way to look at it. He's all, you're joining the winning team. You're joining the winning side. I'm like, what, yeah? And he's all, yeah, you wave the flag, you climb out of the hole, and you join the guys that are whooping your butt. I was like, oh, okay, well, I can surrender to those guys. Like, I want to win. Like, I'm the winner. And, you know, I was blessed to have a father who was in the fellowship, because I was exposed to AA. And I resented AA when I was out there. And one of the beautiful things about this spiritual awakening is my recollection of my childhood is 180 degrees from what it was when I was still drinking, which is really crazy. If you would have asked me when I was drinking what my childhood was like, it'd be pour me a drink, you drink like me. Now when I think about it, I'm like, it was pretty rad. Like, it was good. Because I've learned how to look at things in a different light. And now I know why people say I'm a grateful alcoholic, because I get to say these things and see these things and experience these things in a light that I never got to experience them in. And, you know, my father was a really bad alcoholic, gambler, you know, very difficult to be around. He was in the Vietnam War and suffered from PTSD. And so when I was out there, you know, I had the worst childhood. My dad was a total jerk, and my parents got divorced early, you know, when I was 7 or 8 years old. So I had to bounce back in between those. We had a nice 5-bedroom house or 4-bedroom house with, you know, the perfect house as a kid. And then now I'm living in a condo half the week, and then in a house with bars on the windows and bars on the front gate. And you know, trying to fake it with having one nice pair of jeans instead of a bunch of jeans that I should have been wearing that I could afford. I'd have the one name brand jeans and wear those every day, you know. My mom would be like, you get two, you know, a couple $100 for a school clothes, so I'll buy 150 pair of Jordans and these, like, expensive jeans. And so I have shoes and a pair of jeans so I can try to live that lifestyle. And so I went with my father to, when he first started going to AA meetings, I was in my early 20s and drinking was super fun. I'm not going to lie to you. I had a lot of fun. And I remember sitting in that room And, you know, obviously looking for the differences, you know, I'm not like you, I'm not like you, I'm not like you, they're a loser, I'm still having fun. Oh, wow, you drank so bad that you that happened to you. And I'm starting to hear my story with everybody goes up and shares, but I'm still having fun. But I could totally identify with all you guys. And I'm in my early 20s. And I'm like, damn. All right, I know right now it's manageable mentally, like this is still fun, but I know eventually I'm going to get to where all of you guys are, and I'm so glad to know that there's a place that's going to help me when I'm ready for you guys. I just didn't think it was going to be this young when I did. I imagine I'd be retired and you know. But cool, I got past all that. I don't have to go that far, you know. But it was nice to know that this would be here for me, like... And so when it came to that point to where I was at that crossroads where I could keep doing what I'm doing and I'd lose my family and then it would be the biggest pity party because that's what us good alcoholics do, you know, blame everybody else and drink and be able to drink the way I wanted to drink because no one's monitoring and checking on me. And I would lose, obviously, any visitation rights to my children because I'd be such a mess. I would lose my job because it'd be poor me, you drink too if you had this life. And I'd probably be dead a year from then. So I stood there and I said, well, I know, I'll go to an AA meeting because I know about this place and it'll help me and I'll go there and I'll get everything back. So it's not the right reason to go, you know. We're supposed to go for ourselves, which, you know, you keep coming back, you figure that out. But, you know, that was the selfish reason I went to my first AA meeting. It's like, I know, I'll go to a meeting and I'll get everything back. And then I went to that meeting and 10 minutes in, I was like, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. Oh my God, I'm just like every single person here. That 70-year-old person just told my story. That 19-year-old person just told my story. That 30-year-old woman just told my story. I was like, oh my gosh. And they're all hugging and happy. And, you know, I was like, they're starry-eyed freaks. What's going on here? But I wanted it so bad. I was like, I want what these guys have so bad. So I walked in there with the wrong reasons. I was getting sober for everybody else. And I walked out of there going, I have to do this or I'm going to die. So I guess I jumped ahead. I'm used to these 10 to 15 minute shares. So how long do I have till here? 7:20? How long do I go here?
Five to eight.
All right, let's roll it back a little bit. So, yeah, I grew up in San Jose, California. My parents were married at the time. Dad drank a lot. I think my first drink, I was an infant. Dad would put beer in my baby bottle, so I didn't even have a chance. Like, no chance. I think it was one of those things where, like, he just wanted me to just chill out and shut up. Yeah. I also remember being 5 years old in the backyard watching, we had koi fish ponds, and he'd hang out when he did show up after work. Normally he'd go to the dive bar after work and then show up at 9 and I'd be in sleep listening to my parents fight. But when he would show up, I think probably because he was guilted into coming home straight after work, those rare times, I would sit next to him and I'd go, hey Dad, can I have some? And he'd say, go get a cup. And he'd put a little bit in a cup. And it was so disgusting. And I didn't get any head change. And it wasn't like, the clouds parted and I felt a part of. And it wasn't like that at all. I just wanted my dad to like me. I wanted to be like a grown-up, you know. Like, he would work on something in the yard and I would grab like a meat tenderizer and hit on the porch, you know, like while he's using a hammer on something, you know, just to, you know, try to fit in like that. I didn't really feel out of weird and out of place until they got divorced. And I didn't know what divorce was. I'd never heard that word before. But my parents took us to Casa de Fruta on a Sunday afternoon. And me and my brother and sister, and we're like, this is weird. Like, mom and dad never take us anywhere. So that was like the first, like, something's up. And so I think my mom, she, you know, tries to be like the Leave It to Beaver type mom and wanted us to have like one last family thing before they sat us down and told us. So we go to Casa de Fruta, and it was weird where they fought the whole time there. My dad's smoking cigarettes with the windows rolled up and the AC on, Lincoln Town Car. And we're in the back seat like, we get to Casa de Fruta, played around, got home, and my mom sits us all down with my dad and tells us they're getting a divorce. And I was like second or third grade, and I just remember bawling my eyes out. Like it was like you told me that Santa Claus didn't exist. Because at that age, everything is like mommy and daddy happily ever after, the prince and the princess to become the king and the queen. Like, and it really rocked me because I didn't know anybody in our neighborhood. We lived in like an upper middle class neighborhood in San Jose where, you know, usually the mom stayed home. The dad's worked at some engineering job, you know, and two cars and, you know, 2.5 kids and a dog. And so we were the only family that had a divorced parents. So immediately weird kid, you know. And obviously, I'm not the tallest guy, so that was another one, like short kid. Weird kid, short kid, then poor kid because parents are divorcing, right? So I had all these things in my head that, like, I wasn't good enough. My parents are weird. My dad's the alcoholic, so certain parents in the neighborhood wouldn't let kids come over to my house because they were worried about, you know, the alcoholic dad. And so that was just the beginning of it. That was the beginning of the ism, of the alcoholism. Before I took a drink, that right there just rocked me, the trauma. That's when later on in life, I found the green alcohol. And that was like, wow, this is pretty cool. I'm going to do this a lot. And around the same summer, we had this grand idea in seventh grade to throw a 4th of July party at a friend's house because his parents were out of town. And so we went shoulder tapping. My height, like, you know, shoulder tapping in seventh grade. Can you imagine? Like, hey, sir, can you buy me some wine coolers? So we got 40s of some really bad, like, 99-cent sticker malt liquor. We got wine coolers for the girls because we're going to invite girls and they're going to drink these Barnes & James wine coolers. And then like a bottle of Cuervo and a bunch of dirt weed. I'm sorry, it's part of my story. I don't mean to offend people talking about, you know, other types of alcohol, other outside issues. But we went back to this guy's house and the sun's not even down yet. And it's like 5 o'clock and I just want to fit in. And I'm the whipping boy of the crew, the short one, the one that's got the beat-up Jordans and the beat-up guest jeans because I had to buy the two expensive things instead of a wardrobe of Montgomery Ward's tough skins crap. I'm the butt of the jokes. And so I started taking a drink, and I see their eyes lighting up the longer I held it to my mouth. And I'm like, yeah, I'm cool now, you know? Little did I know that, like, you know, I drank so much that first time that within like 15 minutes, I'm hugging a toilet. Like, I didn't even get to have fun with it. But I did feel accepted from it for about 15 minutes. And then the girl showed up like 45 minutes later, and I've probably gotten sick 4 or 5 times. I have not left the bathroom. It's summertime, no air conditioning, just dripping sweat. And then I've become like it's a zoo, like I'm an attraction. Like, oh, you gotta come see Johnny. Like, and like, I'm looking up at these girls that like, I had crushes on, and they're all like laughing and pointing, and I'm just like, ugh. And that was the first time I prayed to God, God, please make this go away. I swear I'll never drink again. And since it didn't go away, that's why I was like, this God praying stuff doesn't work. Doing the steps, I realized, yeah, I've been doing it wrong. You're not supposed to pray for yourself, dude. You pray for His will, and you pray for other folks to have peace and comfort, and that works. Like, yeah, okay, I'll pray for your will, pray for strength, willing to be willing, and, you know, not, oh, please, you know, why did you take my dog away? I got hit by a car. Like, that's not, you know, that sent me away from religion as a kid, because if God was real, you know, how come so-and-so died of such and such? And I prayed to get that bike from Santa and it never came. It's like, yeah, dude, of course. Idiot. Pray for His will. Power to carry that out. But yeah, that was the beginning of alcohol. It was junior high, and I hated it because I was that nauseous kid, you know, that get car sick. I was like the kid on The Simpsons in the back of the bus that's always like green and getting sick. So, like, I didn't like that, but I liked the other green alcohol because it never made me nauseous. And I could, you can't like drink so or consume so much of it that like you pass out. Like, I guess you kind of can, but not like the alcohol passing out, not the same. So I gravitated to that because it didn't make me sick. But then when I started getting closer to being the age to get into bars and stuff, that's when I started drinking and I had the courage to talk to girls. I had the courage for girls to think I was cute and I could talk to them back. And that was that, cloud spreading, the sun coming through, I've arrived, the warm feeling in your tummy, like all that stuff that people typically talk about with their first time. Yeah, it took me about 6 or 7 years to get to that point. But when I got to that point, vroom. And, you know, I suffer from the obsession of the mind and the physical allergy, you know. My sponsor told me I had an allergy, and I'm like, no, I don't. Like, so I don't break out into hives and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, no, it's an abnormal reaction to something. When you drink, it's an abnormal reaction. Normal people don't drink the way you drink. He's like, I was like, what do you mean? He's all, you're thinking about it right now, aren't you? I was all, well, yeah, kind of. Granted, this is like my first time working with the sponsor when we're having this conversation. And he's like, normal people don't think about alcohol. He's like, have you been dreaming about it? I'm all, yeah, I keep having dreams about it. This is like a week or two into sobriety. And he's like, normal people don't have dreams about drinking. I'm like, oh, okay. And he's like, When you drink, once you start, can you stop? And I was like, well, yeah, when I get the spins, I'll stop. And he's all, yeah, normal people don't do that. He's like, haven't you noticed, like, some people will, like, have, like, a glass of wine or half a glass and leave it on the table? And I go, yeah, that's alcohol abuse. They're wasting alcohol. They're leaving it. And the more I work this process, the more I start realizing how many normies there are. Because when I was drinking, I figured everybody drank like me. I thought everybody was as drunk as I was when I'd be in an environment like that. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm like counting people's drinks. Like, he had three, she had four, he had one and a half. That guy's wasting alcohol. He's a total abuser. I recently went to dinner with a couple, and the guy ordered a mixed drink, took two sips off it. It was like three quarters full and left it for the whole night. And I'm just sitting there like, what a jerk. Normal people don't think that way. But to me, I'm like, you're going to finish that, right? Like, I'm the type of alcoholic that, like, when you get up from a meal and when I was drinking and I'd see that drink, I'd be like, my wife would leave half a beer. And I'm like, hold on, just get the car running. Like, I'll be right there. Like, can't let it go. I can't leave it. It's got to be empty. And so, you know, I consider myself to have a low bottom, but it's still a bottom. I couldn't control how much I drank, and I obsessed over it. Once it hit me, I couldn't stop. And I remember you guys would tell me the first drink will get you drunk. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. The sixth and seventh gets you drunk. It's like, no. You take one drink and you get to six and seven really quick. So I thank you guys for continuing to say that to me, even though I argued it. No, it's not the first drink will get you drunk. I'm like, yeah, it's totally the first drink that'll get you drunk, because, you know, one's too many and 12's not enough. So I drank and drank and drank, and I play in rock bands. I'm a skateboarder, so to me, that was part of my identity, was like the party animal. I mean, you guys see the Jackass stuff, and like those were like my group of friends, like literally. So I thought that was normal. So I surrounded myself with lower companions. I surrounded myself with people that drank the way I did and partied the way I did. So it was normal. It wasn't weird. That's what kept me out of these rooms for so long, was that I thought, since I had a wife, kids, a house, two cars, my skateboarding, my music, and a day job, I didn't have any real consequences other than the consequences between these ears. And that was a prison in its own. But I couldn't see it because I surrounded myself with so many people that were just a little worse than me. Just a little, you know, well, he doesn't have as good of a job as me. Or he lives in a house as a roommate. Or he pees his pants more than I do. He pukes three times, and I puked twice. So, like, that guy's the problem. He's got the problem. He fell asleep at the bar. I fell asleep in the car. At least I had the dignity to go to the backseat of my friend's car that drove us here and sleep so nobody saw it. I mean, he slept at the bar. Like, that's an alcoholic. So I just kept surrounding myself with this lie, and I noticed as I was going to birthday parties for my kids' friends in elementary school and preschools, and I'm like, this party sucks. Like, where's the beer? It's 10 a.m. Like, where's the beer? Where's the whiskey? And I started finding all the other alcoholic dads and party animal dads, and so we started having play dates and barbecues, and it's not about the kids, you know. Self-centeredness and selfishness is the center of my disease. Everything that I did revolved around how can I get mine, and I'll step on anybody to do it. Let's go bowling because they have a full bar. Let's go to Chuck E. Cheese because they sell pitchers of beer. Let's go to the beach boardwalk because they sell beer. It's like everything that I did with my kids centered around, you know. We didn't go to the park because you run out of alcohol there. My thermos is empty. I'm out of brownies. So, you know, that is what kept me out there for so long, was just that lie to myself that everything was okay, it wasn't that bad. But my wife, you know, was starting to taper back because she can, but I can't. You know, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And so this misconception, I'm in a rock band, like, that's how we drink and party. I mean, you've heard of Motley Crue and, like, Guns N' Roses. Like, I'm not slamming vodka yet. Lots of yets, you know? Because had I not found you guys, a lot of these yets would have happened. I just found you guys before the yets. That's the only difference between, you know, the low bottom and the high bottom is the yets. I have a lot of yets, and I don't want those yets to happen. So every day I get to avoid those yets one day at a time. You know, my wife came to me one night and sat next to me calmly and told me that she is not in love with me and wants me out of the house. And she said it calmly. I was like, whoa, she's never said anything calmly to me. Normally she's, you know, she's very, very vocal, you know. She's a fiery woman. That's what I love about her, though, you know. I've never seen her that calm and serious. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Oh, damn. Like, this is real. She told me to pack a bag and come back the next day to grab all my stuff. So I packed a bag and I went to my bass player's house and slept on his couch. And my last drunk is the most pitiful last drunk. It's not even like a cool last drunk. Like, yeah, wrapped a car around a telephone pole, then I ran naked down the street in handcuffs, and then like nothing cool at all, dude. I go to this house and he's a normie that, you know, he could tie it on, but he also can, you know, take it or leave it. And I'm like, what do you got to drink, man? He's like, oh, there's like the liquor cabinet over there, and everything had like this much left in it. Wow, cool. So I start with what I would drink, which would be like the brown liquors, right? So I drink a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and then I look over and he's like, gin? Like, oh, I don't even like gin, but there's... So I drink the gin. Like, we don't drink it for the taste, you know? We drink it for the effect. I don't care what it tastes like. People would always give me a hard time for drinking warm beer or warm whiskey or warm this or warm that. I'm like, I don't give a shit, because once it passes these lips, it doesn't matter where... what it is, you know? Like, it's people talking about, like, oh, these drinks are to die for, they're so delicious, they do this, and then they melt the sugar over it, and like, dude, I don't have that kind of stomach real estate, just give me the bottle. You can keep the shot glass, like, that's more dishes to do. Like, people would come over to the house, and I'd hand them the fifth, like, hey, you want a tug? Like, they're like, whoa, dude, who's your husband again? Like, what? Like, it's like, I pass the bong around, why can't we pass the fifth around? Like, what's wrong with you guys? You need a cup? You want soda? Like, you know how many of those you're gonna have to drink to feel something with soda mixed in there? Like, I don't have that stomach real estate, man. Just fill me up. But I was drinking the weirdest stuff, and I think there might have been some Midori in there or something. Is there even alcohol in that? I don't know. It was in the cabinet. I don't drink wine, like, at all. I hate wine. And there was a bottle of wine with a cork in it. And I'm like, when'd you open that? He's all, I don't know. It's been there a long time. That was the last thing I drank, because that was the last thing in that his house. But I didn't get, like, drunk. I just got, like, drunk enough to realize that it's not fun anymore. It's not the answer to my problems. It made me feel worse. It made me realize that I was hiding alcohol. To my own innermost self, I was like, I am really out of control, because normal people don't hide a bottle of whiskey in their garage and then go out back to have a cigarette and then slide into the garage to take a 1, 2, 3 slug and come back. And then go back into the backyard and light another cigarette and no one's looking. I go back. Then I'd crack a beer to, like, oh, if I drink beer right after drinking all that whiskey, I could just say, well, you saw me drink a beer. I wasn't drinking whiskey. Now, I'm sober now, and I could tell you what you drank and how much you drank it just by walking by. I'm like, vodka, whiskey, beer, like, I wasn't fooling anybody, but I thought I was totally fooling everybody. And my wife was like, you drank whiskey, didn't you? And I'm like, no, I was like, oh, I got this beer. And this whole time, like, I'm lying to myself. Like, no, it's just beer. I would run home to slam a beer to hide the whiskey smell. And then, like, I would grab a few beers and slug them down and crush the can. So then if I was slurring my words, I'm like, you saw how many cans of beer are up there. And so I'm just, all this is going through my head after drinking a little of that and a little of that and a little of that. Not even enough to, like, black out. Not enough to get the spins. Not enough to throw up. I didn't even have any weed. Like, I was scraping my pipe. Like, it was the worst. It was, like, the most embarrassing last drunk. Like, it was so dumb. And so the next morning I wake up and my wife isn't taking my calls. And I wake up on a couch and I feel like crap because, you know, I got maybe 3 hours of sleep, and I had this misconception that if I get to work at 6 a.m. before everyone else, I'm not an alcoholic, because alcoholics don't get to work at 6 a.m., an hour or two before everyone else. And I would smoke a bunch of weed on the way to work so then I could get rid of the hangover, and I'd go in there with my eyes all jacked up, and there was a guy that was in our fellowship that was just patiently waiting, just waiting, waiting. His name's John R. He's no longer with us. He passed away in his sleep from a flu or a cold or something like that. He didn't go out. But he used to sit next to me at work and see me all jacked up in the morning. And he'd just laugh at me, and he would tell me drunkologs. Like, he was doing the good 12-step stuff. Like, just share your story, and hopefully they'll share back with you. And don't push it. You know, just doing the good stuff, you know. He had 20-plus years of sobriety. He knew my dad was in the fellowship. But he would try to relate to me and tell me about all his different wives that he lost because of drinking and all stuff. Like, he knew exactly what he was doing. But at the time, I just was like, what's this crazy guy? Like, I'm not as bad as this guy. Like, that guy's a loser. Like, you know? Like, you guys all in this AA means you guys are all losers. And I'm like, no, you guys are the winners, dude. I'm the loser. I couldn't identify. You know, everybody's totally different than me. Nobody understands me. Me, 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 me. You know, thinking about is me, talking about me, me, me. And so finally I walked up to John that morning, and I called my wife's mom, and I'm all, hey, Mandy's not taking my calls. Is, like, everything okay? And she's like, you know what she's really worried about is, like, you're drinking. And I hang up the phone, and I'm like, oh, that's it? I'll go to AA, and I'll, like, get my family back. Yeah, that's what I'll do. So stupid. So I go to John, and I'm all, hey, John, can I talk to you? And I'm shaking, because for the first time, I'm about to admit something, not only to myself, to another person, but really to myself. And I go, hey, John, I have a problem with alcohol, and I'm going to go check out an AA meeting. I just Googled it, like I did all the research before I went to talk to John. I'm like, AA San Jose, return. 4 o'clock. I could do four. I could do four. That'll give me time to get off work, go do the 4 o'clock, and then probably go back to the house at 5, start packing my stuff. And so I go over to John. I'm like, hey, John, so, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I need help, and I'm going to go to AA meeting. What do I do? And he's just like, like, finally. Yes. You know, kid, I've been waiting a long time for this talk. And he's like, come talk, come with me. We go into a conference room, and he's like, all right, all you got to do is take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. You know, it's just typical AA stuff. And he's like, sit in the back, shut your mouth, and if they call on you, pass. And I was all, oh, that sounds easy enough. He's all, okay, well, can you do that? And I'm all, yeah, I can do that. So, like, 3:15, I leave the office a little early, and I pull up to that meeting. I'm just praying that the door is locked. And, like, I'm walking up, and I'm like, I can't believe I'm doing this. One, I'm going to a church. Am I going to catch on fire walking in here? Like, because, you know, I'm not religious, you know? And I walk in, I pull the door the wrong way, and I'm like, look, it's locked! And I'm like, oh. And I'm about to turn around, and someone's like, you gotta push the door. Well, oh, all right. I go in there and I sit down. They start doing the reading and stuff, and I'm starting to like shake, and I'm tripping out, and I'm sitting in the back of the room, and you guys can all smell it on me. You know that I'm like, all of you guys, you're like, yeah, newcomer. I need to stay sober. And I saw all you guys hugging each other, and I saw all you guys laughing, but like real laughing, not like barroom laughing, but like genuine laughing. And I'm like, fuck, dude, what's in, is that coffee in there? Like, what's in that coffee? And I just saw you guys, how you treat each other, like true compassion and true love for each other and true happiness and stuff like I hadn't seen since I couldn't really remember. Maybe before the divorce, maybe before the Casa de Fruta incident. I don't know, but and on a side note, I drove by Casa de Fruta with my wife a bunch of times and didn't know why I'd clench my jaw and just have a resentment every time I drove by it because I blacked that whole thing out and working this process opened it back up, but I had no idea, and then it hit me and I'm like, fucking Casa de Fruta. That was, and then boom, like I told my wife, I'm like, dude, this is what, now I know why. So then we made this ritual when we go to Disneyland. We always stop at Casa de Fruta as a family to have lunch with the kids to turn it around. Like, now we're going to make Casa de Fruta a happy place for our family, which is pretty neat. So anyways, so I'm in my first AA meeting for me because, you know, I went with my dad just to support my father, you know, and was like, whoa, you guys, seriously, I'll be back. So I was back, and I just wanted what you guys had so badly, and then the basket comes around, and I pull out my wallet, and all I had was a 20, which I would have spent at a happy hour anyways, right? Like, $20, that'll get, you know, some drinks or whatever. So I didn't know what to do, and at the same time, I was like, you guys are like, giving me more than what happy hour would have gave me. Like, so I'm just going to throw the 20 in. And the guy next to me goes, this is your first meeting, isn't it? His name's Rob. I still see him, and I always bring that up to him. Rob, he's cool. And I was like, how can you tell? And he's all, nobody puts a 20 in the basket. Hey, get this kid some change. I'm like, dude, trying to stay low key. I might get recognized. These people drank at the bars I drank at. So yeah, that was really embarrassing because it kind of like stopped the flow of the meeting. Like, change. And then, you know, the crotchety old timer's like, oh, can you hurry up and get this kid 18 ones already? You know, come on, we got a good meeting starts on time and ends on time. Yeah, so I was like, all right, even more pressure now. Like, and those very people saved my life, you know. But that first meeting, I was intimidated. I'm like, man, you lighten up. I thought you guys were like happy, joyous, and free. Whatever. Oh, tightwads. So meanwhile, I'm like rolling up 18 ones. They're like, one, two, and everybody's staring at me. Like, the whole meeting stopped. All because some ding-dong threw a 20 in there. Get this kid some change! But the gal that shared told my story to the T, and I was like, dang, she's 10 years younger than me. She, a woman, you know, like, talked about how she'd wake up in the morning on a Saturday morning and walk past the bottle that was on the kitchen table from the night before and just be like, oh, hair of the dog. A little sip couldn't hurt, like, you know, help the hangover. Go in the backyard, light a cigarette, take a few puffs off the other outside issue, green alcohol. And then as you walk back into the kitchen again, you're like, oh, there's that bottle again. Where'd you come from? Take another sip. Meanwhile, you do that enough times and you're like, you got the shampoo effect. Like, you know, when you're in the shower and put the shampoo in, your hair's all foamy. And then like a few minutes later, like the foam's gone. It's like there's nothing in there. And you go, just a little bit of water. Boom. It's right back. That was like me with drinking the next morning. It'd be like, I go to bed, blacked out, drunk. And then the shampoo effect after like two or three beers and some weed, like, or two or three shots and some weed. And like, bam, up 3 in the morning again. At 9 in the morning. And, yeah, so I was doing that. And my wife would, I'd tell her to, like, sleep in. My kids would wake up at 5 or 6 in the morning because they're really, really young. And I would be doing that. And my wife would come out and we'd be, like, dancing to Jerry Lee Lewis at 9 in the morning. And I'm like, hey, I'm the fun dad. Like, I'm totally wasted. It's 9 in the morning. So I heard her tell that story. And I'm like, oh, wow, okay. And then after the meeting, her boyfriend was a guy that apparently I used to drink with. I don't remember him, but whatever. He worked at one of the bars my band played at. And he's like, yeah, Johnny, yeah, dude, I saw your band like 6 months ago. Like, you guys were rad. I got 6 months sober. I got sober after I partied with you that night. I'm like, oh, damn, what do we do? So they helped me out early on, you know. You guys all surrounded me after that first meeting because obviously I'm the guy that put the $20 bill in the basket. I was like, ah. After the meeting, and I got lots of phone numbers. I started going to that meeting. It was my home group. Like, I started to crave sobriety more than I craved drugs and alcohol. I have a lot of normies say, like, well, you stopped drinking, so, like, why do you keep going? Like, you graduated. Here's your diploma. You're cured. Like, no. It doesn't work that way. I crave sobriety. I crave you guys. I crave these rooms. I crave being able to just be with people that understand me and laugh at the stories instead of, like, oh, dude, you're, whoa. Like, that first meeting, I heard you guys telling, like, some of the craziest stories, and they were like, ha, 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 yeah, you shit your pants. How many times? Oh, rookie, 3 times? Check this out. I just did it sober. It was a love and friendships that I never, ever imagined, and it had only been 5 minutes. These people loved me till I could love myself. Everybody gave me their phone numbers. They were checking on me. It was like an hour after this meeting, this guy Dave, his late 60s, calls me an hour after, and I'm sitting there like, poor me, like, I'm gonna lose my family and all stuff. But you guys gave me hope that, one, I had a problem, and two, there was a solution, and I was like, I walked into this room to save my family, and I'm walking out to save my life and save my sanity. And just that one meeting, that 1 hour, just made a whole transformation inside of me where I just wanted it so bad. And I was willing to do anything you guys told me. If you would say, you want to stay sober today? See that dog park? Go scoop poop for an hour. It'll keep you sober. I would have done it because that's what I've learned in this program is do what you don't want to do, because when you avoid that, that's what we were doing. We were avoiding what we didn't want to do, what we didn't want to face, what we didn't want to walk through. We would bury it. Whatever, you know, your outside issue is, you bury it. And so I learned that everything's got to be awkward and uncomfortable. Otherwise, you're not recovering. That's been my experience. What's worked for me is doing what I do not want to do. But I remember, you know, in those first 90 days, everybody that had something to help me with, I'd listen to it and I tried it. And it worked. You know, like everything you guys said, no matter what it was, no matter how stupid I thought it was, or that guy that I met that I partied with the last night, you know, he's like, go home and pray. That'll keep you sober. Oh, really? Fucking weirdo. Yeah, sure. Pray. Thoughts and prayers, bro. It worked. So I just kept trying stuff. You guys would tell me, and I'm like, fake it till you make it. Just keep doing it. And so what I've learned, you know, is take suggestions, do what I don't want to do, work with others. The real happiness that I get is when I'm doing something for somebody else and not expecting anything in return. My sponsor taught me when I was not feeling well, call a newcomer. So he'd have me get a number of someone with more time and someone with less time. And I'm like, but I only got 2 weeks. He's all, that guy's got 2 days. He's looking at you like a god. Like, he's not going to listen to the guy with 20 years. Like, yeah, 20 years, whatever. How'd you do 2 days? Like, wow, that's amazing. So if you're new, reach out to people with less time. Give them your number. Because to them, you're a god. You've got 30 days. Like, how'd you do that? I can't even get 12 hours. Hey, I'll call my sponsor. Hey, poor me, baby. Call a drunk. Call a newcomer. Get out of your own head and someone else's. So, you know, I just want to thank all you guys for showing me, you know, what it's like to live a real life and a selfless life, and to show me how to help others, and show me how to realize that the world doesn't revolve around me. You know, I'm just a worker among workers, and. I want to thank you all for keeping me sober and bringing me down here. And if you're new, you're in the right place. Just keep coming back. More will be revealed every day. No matter how much time you have, more is revealed. You just keep learning. You keep growing. You grow or go. What isn't growing is dying. Whether it's a tree, whether it's a business, whatever. If it's not growing, it's dying. There's only two ways you can go. So just keep coming back. Keep growing. Thank you. I'm Johnny. I'm an alcoholic.
I don't have how to turn off your phone, so you'll have to do that. Thank you, Johnny. Thank you very much for coming from San Jose. We appreciate it.